Some people may think, with good reason, that I chose such a topic because I didn't think I had enough to say on just Christianity or poetry, so I decided I'd better have a couple subjects so I could fill the time. I should explain why the title seems so huge, what I mean by it. I didn't mean Christian poetry, because some of the poetry I'm going to read is by non-Christians and doesn't express a Christian view of the world. But I wanted to include those people too. What I'm going to do tonight is read some poems, not very many, which are about Christianity, some by Christians, some by others. And I'd like you to do some thinking. I just want to provoke some thinking about the uses of poetry and other art forms for the Christian church. Why should we in the church be interested in art forms? Of what use are they to us? What can their function or purpose be in the church? It seems to me we have certainly embraced the use of music in our worship services and in our Christian life. I don't know what the theory behind that is, but certainly the church has always, especially the Lutheran church, had a great deal of superb music, which have been an integral part of the worship experience and certainly enhanced it. And I suppose one could say that in studying the Bible, we study a great deal of very fine poetry. Nevertheless, I think that most people, Christians included, view the arts, and this includes poetry, in the church at any rate, primarily as a means of supporting beliefs they already have. Poets may find nice ways of saying some things that we feel, and so that kind of poetry we like to read. If you think of the music that the musicians sang last night, and it was a superb singing group, a concert I think we all enjoyed very much. For those of you who weren't here last night, we had a group of 8 young people. What was their name now? Spirit Born. And they sang a number of good Christian songs, many of them new to us, and I'm sure entertained us all and moved us. But I would say those songs, like most Christian poetry that we use in our churches, did not address major questions that we have to confront as Christians. We always knew the outcome. We knew that there was going to be a happy affirmation of Christianity at the end, as there was. And this is important for us. It helps us build our community. However, I think there are several other uses for poetry, ways we can use poetry in a church. And I'd like to suggest some and just read some different kinds of poetry by wildly different poets, and I can't claim that these are all great poets or great poems, but they just represent some very different kinds of ways in which writers have written about Christianity. Incidentally, there's very little literature in the English language that isn't influenced by the Christian church, whether it was explicitly Christian, explication of Christian doctrine, as much of medieval writings are, or whether it is a rejection of Christianity, as many of the 20th century, or I should say 19th century writings have been, or an attempt to find some replacement for that lack, as many 20th century writings have been. English literature has almost always addressed the question of Christian faith. So, one way that writers have written about Christianity is to use some of the, use the church as subject matter in order to make fun of it and have fun. I'm going to read a poem by Ogden Nash called Ha, Original Sin. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity that's any fun at all for humanity. Food is vanity, so is drink, and undergarments of gossamer pink. P.G. Wodehouse and long vacations, going abroad and rich relations, the kind of engagements you want to keep, 100 honors and 12 hours sleep. Vanity's all, oh, wara, wara, rooted in Sodom and Gomorrah. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity that's any fun at all for humanity. That is the gist of the prophet's case, from Bishop Cannon to Canon Chase. The prophets chant and the prophets chatter, but somehow it never seems to matter, for the world hangs on to its ancient sanity and orders another round of vanity. Then hey for Gomorrah and nani for Sodom, Marie, the Chanel number 5 from Autumn. Nash always writes like that. He doesn't take any subject seriously. But a lot of fun has been made of the church in ways like that. There's another little poem I want to read you by a poet named Piet Hein, Danish poet, writes short little epigrammatic poems, some of which are funny and provocative. This one is called Larges, a Grook. Oh, his poems are called Grooks, all of them. There's a number of volumes called Grooks 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Larges, a Grook about the giving of one's plenty. It's pleasant to give without feeling the price. So let us be nobly profuse of the bottomless treasure of moral advice we anyhow never make use of. I've got a couple other poems in a different vein, also by people not expressing an explicitly Christian view. These next two poems are by what I would call modern writers. The first one, but Thomas Hardy, writing about the turn of the century. The second one, Philip Larkin, written in the 1950s, both about the lack of Christianity at the center of the culture, the loss of Christianity as the central ordering force in the culture, and the failure to find any replacement that we feel in both of these writers. Moving poems, both of them. First one's a very simple one by Hardy called The Oxen. It sets the scene at Christmas that we'll be celebrating here soon. This is an old man speaking. Christmas Eve and 12 of the clock. Now they're all on their knees, an elder said as we sat in a flock by the embers in hearthside ease. We pictured the meek, mild creatures where they dwelt in their strawy pen. Nor did it occur to one of us there to doubt they were kneeling then. So fair a fancy few would weave in these years. Yet I feel if someone said on Christmas Eve, come, see the oxen kneel in the lonely barton by yonder coombe our childhood used to know, I should go with him in the gloom, hoping it might be so. That kind of sense of loss when Christianity ceased to be at the center, particularly of English culture, in the late 19th century, after the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, is a prevalent theme right through much of modern literature. This next poem I'm going to read is called Church Going by Philip Larkin. It's about a kind of activity that any of us who have visited Europe, or particularly England, I think, Ireland, as he's talking about here, we've all done. It's about a man visiting an old church. And Christine and I have been lucky enough to travel in England several times in the last few years. We find this is one of our favorite activities. Every little church holds some new interest, some new interesting detail. They're quiet, beautiful places. And it's one of our favorite activities while touring to do what this man is doing, church going. Once I am sure there's nothing going on, I step inside, letting the door thud shut. Another church, mattings, seats, and stone, and little books, sprawlings of flowers cut for Sunday, brownish now, some brass and stuff up at the holy end, the small, neat organ, and a tense, musty, unignorable silence, brewed God knows how long. Hatless, I take off my cycle clips in awkward reverence, move forward, run my hand around the font. From where I stand, the roof looks almost new, cleaned or restored. Some would know, I don't. Mounting the lectern, I peruse a few hectoring large-scale verses and pronounce, "Here endeth," much more loudly than I'd meant. The echoes snigger briefly. Back at the door, I sign the book, donate an Irish sixpence, reflect the place was not worth stopping for. Yet stop I did. In fact, I often do, and always end up much at a loss like this, wondering what to look for. Wondering, too, when churches fall completely out of use, what we shall turn them into, if we shall keep a few cathedrals chronically on show, their parchment, plate, and picks in locked cases, and let the rest rent-free to rain and sheep. Shall we avoid them as unlucky places? Or after dark will dubious women come to make their children touch a particular stone, pick simples for a cancer, or on some advised night see walking a dead one? Power of some sort or other will go on in games, in riddles, seemingly at random, but superstition, like belief, must die, and what remains when disbelief has gone? Grass, weedy pavement, brambles, buttress, sky, a shape less recognizable each week, a purpose more obscure. I wonder who will be the last, the very last, to seek this place for what it was. One of the crew that tap and jot and know what rood lofts were. Some ruined bibber, randy for antique, or Christmas addict, counting on a whiff of gown and bands and organ pipes and myrrh. Or will he be my representative? Bored, uninformed, knowing the ghostly silt dispersed, yet tending to this cross of ground through suburb scrub, because it held unspilt so long and equably what since is found only in separation, marriage and birth and death and thoughts of these. For whom was built this special shell? For though I've no idea what this accoutered, frousty barn is worth, it pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized and robed as destinies. And that much never can be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious, and gravitating with it to this ground, which, he once heard, was proper to grow wise in, if only that so many dead lie round. A little bit long, isn't it? That this poet clearly is not a Christian. He feels he's living in a post-Christian era, wondering when it's going to die out completely. I think this kind of poem is also important for us in the church to read, to understand how we are seen by other people, to recognize, to be shocked sometimes into some of the developments of the modern world. At a place like Holden, it's hard to imagine that Christianity is dying. When you go into a church in Norway on Sunday, it's hard to imagine that a place like Holden exists. The next poem I'm going to read provides another kind of... very few people attend church in Norway or in any other European countries. The churches are almost empty. They're state churches, and everybody belongs. They go there to get married, baptized, and buried.
when we traveled in Norway this summer, our friends told us that 99% of the citizens of Norway belong to the church, and 2% attend. So that's the state of the church in Norway. Right?
Yeah. It's a very moving poem by Larkin. You feel that this man, though he doesn't care a fig for Christianity, knows there's something spiritual about this place, and he knows there's a need for something spiritual in him and in all of us. But the church doesn't feel that need for him anymore. Here's another poem. This is one of my favorite poems about the church. It's a satire. It provides another kind of service, as I was starting to say, as a kind of a gadfly on the church, not simply making fun of things like vanity, vanity, all is vanity, really through satire suggesting some, I think, fairly important weaknesses in the church, and partly because this author, Howard Nemiroff, really does care. It's called Boom. It's headed by a short news article written by the Associated Press in June 1957. I don't think this same article could have come out this year. We'll see. President Eisenhower's pastor said tonight that Americans are living in a period of unprecedented religious activity. That part, we might say there's a religious revival, certainly, caused partially by paid vacations, the eight-hour day, and modern conveniences. These fruits of material progress, said the Reverend Edward L. R. Nelson of National Presbyterian Church in Washington, have provided the leisure, the energy, and the means for a level of human and spiritual values never before reached. Modern conveniences and the eight-hour day and paid vacations lead to greater spirituality. Here's what Howard Nemiroff has to say about that. The first line refers to an emperor of Rome named Vespasian, who was emperor during a time when the Romans were known for indulging themselves excessively. Here at the Vespasian Carlton, it's just one religious activity after another. The sky is constantly being crossed by cruciform airplanes, in which nobody disbelieves for a second. And the tide of material progress and prosperity miraculously keeps rising to a level never before attained. The churches are full, the beaches are full, and the filling stations are full. God's great ocean is full of paid vacationers praying an eight-hour day to the human and spiritual values, the fruits, the leisure, the energy, and the means, Lord, the means for the level, the unprecedented level, and the modern conveniences, which also are full. Never before, O Lord, have the prayers and praises from belfry and phone booth, from ballpark and barbecue, the sacrifices so endlessly ascended. It was not thus when Job in Palestine sat in the dust and cried bitterly. When Damien kissed the lepers on their wounds, it was not thus. It was not thus when Francis worked a 14-hour day strictly for the birds. When Dante took a week's vacation without pay and it rained part of the time, it was not thus. But now the gears mesh and the tires burn and the ice chatters in the shaker and the priest in the pulpit. And thy name, O Lord, is kept before the public while the fruits ripen and religion booms and the level rises and every modern convenience runneth over. That it may never be with us as it hath been with Athens and Karnak and Nagasaki, nor thy sun for one instant refrain from shining on the rainbow Buick by the breezeway or the Chris Craft with the uplift life raft, that we may continue to be the just folks we are, plain people with ordinary superliners and disposable diaper liners, people of the stop and shop and pray as you go, of hotel, motel, botel, the humble pilgrims of no deposit, no return, and please adjust thy clothing, who will give to thee, if thee will keep us going, our annual Miss Universe, for thy name's sake. Amen. Maybe that's a little bit strong satire for us, but I think we feel in there some of the attitudes that our culture often has, certainly many of the attitudes that Douglas Hall accuses us of having in his book, which is the theme for this summer, Lighten Our Darkness. about which, incidentally, I'm going to talk on Saturday. Now, of course, until this time, I haven't read poems which are strong expressions of Christian belief, and that's what I'd like to do now. The next few poems are poetic expressions of doctrine, I guess, and they provide a special kind of service for us in revealing Christian doctrine with the strength of poetic imagery. Very simple, concrete images which carry the meaning of doctrine, which sometimes is a little hard to grasp otherwise. The first one is called Spring and Fall. It's by Gerard Manley Hopkins. Not an easy poem. Hopkins' poems are never easy to understand logically as you listen to them. The sounds, however, are beautiful. I think you'll understand this anyway as I read it. It's spoken by an older man addressing a young girl, and his subject is mortality. The girl is lamenting the fall of leaves in the autumn. Spring and fall to a young child. Margaret, are you grieving over golden grove unleaving? Leaves like the things of man you with your fresh thoughts care for, can you? Ah, as the heart grows older, it will come to such sights colder by and by, nor spare a sigh though worlds of wanwood leaf meal lie. And yet you will weep and know why. Now no matter, child, the name, sorrow's springs are the same. Nor mouth had no nor mind expressed what heart heard of, ghost guessed. It is the blight man was born for. It is Margaret you mourn for. It's the middle of the poem is a little confusing, but the very simple idea that when we mourn at the fall of leaves in the fall, it is because we have some kind of sense of our own mortality, I think is a wonderfully sensitive idea. Hopkins' poetry is a real favorite among most Christians. There are some books of Hopkins' poetry in the bookstore. One of them is on special, 40% off, I think. And I'll be reading a few more by him. Next poet I'm going to read a few poems by is George Herbert. I should have said, excuse me, Hopkins was a Roman Catholic priest who died in 1888. Never published any of his poems during his lifetime, and in fact, though he was a great poet and knew it, stopped writing poetry for 10 years during the prime of his life because he felt it distracted him from his meditative life. And for a man who died at 44, that 10 years is a significant amount. This next poet is George Herbert. He was an Anglican priest in the 17th century. Writes in a different style, a very simple, homey style. And I'm going to read you a couple of my favorite poems by Herbert. The first one is called Death. And he characterizes death as a skeleton in his poem. But notice the shift in the middle of the poem when he changes from the pre-Christian view of death to the Christian view of death. That skeleton also changes in character, and that's what his poem is about. Using the very concrete image of a skeleton to get at the idea of what Christianity means for us about death. Death, thou wast once an uncouth, hideous thing, nothing but bones, the sad effect of sadder groans. Thy mouth was open, but thou couldst not sing. For we considered thee as at some 6 or 10 years hence, after the loss of life and sense, flesh being turned to dust and bones to sticks. We looked on this side of thee, shooting short, where we did find the shells of fledged souls left behind, dry dust which shed no tears, but may extort. But since our Savior's death did put some blood into thy face, thou art grown fair and full of grace, much in request, much sought for as a good. For we do now behold thee gay and glad as at doomsday, when souls shall wear their new array, and all thy bones with beauty shall be clad. Therefore, we can go die as sleep, and trust half that we have unto an honest, faithful grave, making our pillows either down or dust. The last stanza is a little bit confusing. We can go die as sleep. We can die as easily as we can sleep. Our pillows may be down or dust. We don't care because we have the new vision of death as a doomsday when all the skeletons will wear their glad array. There's one other set of poems I want to read for you. These have been expressions, I think, of doctrine, the kinds of poems that we use a great deal in our hymnal, for instance, though clearly our hymns are a little bit easier to understand than some of these. They're similar in their affirmation of our faith. These poems to follow are also affirmations. This first one, also by Herbert, is a poem which addresses the difficulty of the Christian life, as very few poems I know. This man is an Anglican priest, but struggling with his faith, and he writes a poem which is as beautiful an expression of a struggle with faith as I know. An unusual form in this poem, and a bunch of images that are complicated, but I think you'll feel what's going on here. The poet, the priest, if you will, is rebelling against the Christian life that he's living, and begins to cry out to God and reject what he's doing and get angry. And this goes on for much of the poem, and then you'll hear what happens at the conclusion. The poem is called The Collar. The Collar. You can think of that as a collar which binds us, as the priest's turnaround collar, as the disease collar. I struck the board and cried, "No more! I will abroad! What? Shall I ever sigh and pine? My lines and life are free, free as the road, loose as the wind and large as store. Shall I be still in suit? Have I no harvest but a thorn to let me blood and not restore what I've lost with cordial fruit? Sure there was wine before my sighs did dry it. There was corn before my tears did drown it. Is the year only lost to me? Have I no bays to crown it, no flowers, no garlands gay, all blasted, all wasted? Not so, my heart, but there is fruit, and thou hast hands. Recover all thy sigh-blown age on double pleasures. Leave thy cold dispute of what is fit and not. Forsake thy cage, thy rope of sands, which petty thoughts have made, and made to thee good cable to enforce and draw and be thy law, while thou didst wink and wouldst not see. Away! Take heed, I will abroad. Call in thy death's head there, tie up thy fears. He that forbears to suit and serve his need deserves his load. But as I raved and grew more fierce and wild at every word, methought I heard one calling, "Child," and I replied, "My Lord." One of the things that's obvious about this poem, though the images are confusing, is the roughness of the verse. All this shouting and questioning and broken sentences and kind of messed up imagery, actually, until that final four lines, which are much smoother, quieter, and rhyme nicely, But as I raved and grew more fierce and wild at every word, methought I heard one calling, "Child," and I replied, "My Lord." Now one question I want to ask about this poem, and about the ones that follow, before I read them, is, can poetry like this be used to convert anybody? We often try to explain Christianity to non-Christians logically, but as we know, faith, a mystery like Christian faith, cannot ever be perfectly, convincingly explained logically. A poet like Herbert tries here to explain it poetically with an aesthetic form, just as Bach explains it musically. And I throw this question out. Is Christian poetry more than just a poetry to reinforce our beliefs, but to, or to enlighten, reveal to us new things about our beliefs, but also to persuade others, to convince others in a non-rational way of the truth of Christianity? I don't know the answer to that question, you might think about that as I read these next two poems, again by Gerard Manley Hopkins. This next one I'm going to read is called Pied Beauty. It's one of my favorite poems. Christina and I included this poem in our marriage service. And this spring I heard Wayne Booth, a famous literary critic, speaking at the chapel at St. Olaf College. He gave a short chapel talk entitled, "It's Just Not That Simple." The gist of his chapel talk, I'll explain, I'm getting to back to this poem eventually. The gist of his chapel talk was that in our new scientific age, we have constantly sought new ways of explaining the world which simplify it. Copernican view of the universe worked fine, but when Kepler suggested that the sun was the center of our solar system rather than the earth, it greatly simplified our understanding of all these things spinning around out there. So we started to say, yes, the sun is at the center, the sun is the still point. Though, of course, it too, like the whole galaxy, is spinning around. And constantly we have tried to apply a simpler vision of what's going on to the world to help us understand this very complex place. We put a great deal of faith in science, and Booth's point was that he felt sometimes we carry this process too far. We begin to think that the whole world can somehow sometime be explained in scientific terms, in logical terms. It only waits for the discoveries to be made. We only lack the time to finally come up with those theories which will explain everything. Booth's point was, it's just not that simple. And he concluded his address by saying, I want to read you this poem and ask, is there any other way, is there any scientific way to explain the thing that this poem does? Pied, in Pied Beauty, it means dappled, short for peopled like a horse. Here's the poem. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire-coal chestnut falls, finches' wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades, their gear, and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange, whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how. With swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle, dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him. Christine wanted me to rewrite the last two lines of that poem. Try to neutralize the male image of God in it, but it's a beautiful poem nonetheless. I'm going to conclude with one more poem by Hopkins, my favorite of his. Again, an affirmation of the presence of God, this time in a world which he describes as a polluted, ugly industrial world in his first few stanzas. And the remarkable thing about Hopkins' vision is that even in the ugliness of the industrial world, he sees the grandeur of God. This poem is called God's Grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs. Because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings. That's my last poem for you. You might, I don't know if any of you have some thoughts about the question I was asking toward the end, can we use poetry to convert people? Can poetry, or any art form for that matter, persuade people of the truth of Christianity when logic cannot? Or must we look to literature and painting and music merely as the kind of aesthetic embellishment to our worship service, which it certainly is, and that's no detriment to it. On the other hand, you can just ask me some questions about these poets if you like. Any comments?
I think poetry can express the emotion that goes along with Christianity. And maybe that's where the root of faith is. And that,
you know,
where logic would tend to fall short.
Yeah. I think I'd agree, and most of us probably would, that the emotion that's important to us in this spiritual experience is often expressed in poetry, in a way that it isn't in logical explanations. I wonder if that is. Do you think that a non-Christian hearing God's grandeur also understands that emotion?
I think he can. It's possible.
If so, then that's a terrific power that the arts could have in the world. I would think churches would certainly want to support the arts if they can somehow express that kind of the kind of feeling that faith is, you know.
I was thinking about the power that the hymns have, and aren't they considered poetry?
Certainly, yeah.
They have so much power.
Yeah. They have the virtue of combining the words with music and intensifying, our musician here, I've forgotten his name, was explaining. Pardon? Even
there?
Yeah. I think it was he who was introducing us to a new hymn the other day that had been commissioned by the church, and the words had been written first, and then the writer, the poet, had brought the music, I think, to Dave Brubeck, or the poem to Dave Brubeck to compose music for. And Brubeck said, "What do you want?" He said, "Well, I want you to intensify the text, of course." And that's the way music and lyrics in songs always work. They kind of intensify one another. And certainly that's one of the important parts of our worship experience. The other remarks? Yeah.
Oh, Maury in London, just witnessing, seeing beautiful paintings by Pascal, and having my daughter explain, as being an art history student, explain the emotions and moods of those painters brought, you know, just tingles to. I've never had anyone explain emotions like before, but I do believe that music, poetry, and art can bring one, or at least, well, I think this is very
cool. Yeah. One thing that that we experience in an art museum is the faith of a different age and the nature of the faith of a different age, such as Hardy refers to in The Oxen. You know, if only I could have those days back when I had that simple faith. And I think he's speaking for the whole culture there. Sometimes I think we feel that way when we walk into an art museum and we see that every painting is a Christian subject, or every second painting in the 15th century. But in the 20th century, we don't see very many. These poems I've read, I think, too, reveal that kind of thing to us historically.
Do you see any change in that regard at all? Is there any...
Currently, just in the 70s, sort of?
Are you hearing more poets that are willing to communicate their faith in an overt way, or...
I haven't, I should confess that I'm, like most teachers of literature, relatively ignorant about the most recent things that have been written, because there's so much to keep up with that one waits for it to sift out a little bit. but I don't think I've seen any evidence that there's a kind of revival among writers. Most of the major writers of the 50s and 60s seem to not have any faith or any real strong central idea to replace Christian faith with. And as a result, we get these very psychological novels about people who are upset about the world and don't understand it and feel alienated from everything. And very confused.
There do seem to be several poets, like David Blogg, for instance, who is a Minnesota poet, who are exploring Eastern religion and trying to combine that with Western thought and spiritual experience. And so they tend to come out more, they're more exploring more the Eastern religion and their response to that and its effect on their lives than a Christian religion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a school of poets who are working in that way with Eastern religion.
That's right. You see the writers seeking something to replace what they see. I think most of them see as a kind of a lost Christianity. It's unfortunate, but most of the writers see it that way. And they're looking for other ways of, I guess it's that the church seems to be locked into something that isn't good, and they're looking for ways of bringing something else. Starting with the Beats in the 50s, we had a lot of interest in Eastern religion. Yeah.
I was wondering about your question about using it to convert to the Christian church. I think that poetry or the arts can be really beneficial in just raising up our level of humanity or making us more humane, more courageous, more willing to love and to heighten or to enlarge our circles of concern. Like Robert Bly might be experimenting with Eastern religion, but when I read his poem about my elbows on the table with my children, touching my elbows with my children's elbows on the table, and all the love that's flowing around, those might be called Christian virtues. He has written a beautiful poem about familial love. And I don't care if he's East or West, he's writing about virtues that I would like people to first embrace, and then perhaps people will then look at the Christian faith and say, ah, and that's a faith that expresses those virtues. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really interested in a direct conversion to the church, but I like it when artists write about things that might be a catalyst to the church.
Mm-hmm.
Or I think of another person, maybe people here are familiar with her, Annie Dillard, who has written some beautiful things about nature. She's a woman who's lived by herself and has unusual insight into how nature reflects human nature. I don't know if she's Christian or not, but she calls us to such an awareness that that's good. And maybe from there a person will begin to look at the Christian faith and say, and the Christian faith too calls us to an awareness of the beauty of creation.
Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to the original question I asked either, but I know living in Decorah, Iowa for about 10 years. We encountered some people like Robert Bly, and others that came.
Mm-hmm.
At Luther College is a very fine poetess, Henrietta Grindall,
right.
who speaks now about her religious faith and heritage, and she does it in a very innocent and very straightforward way, which I sort of feel maybe a while back might not have been possible.
Yeah, I think you're right. Now that you've mentioned that, I think there's evidence that it's certainly the environment just is more acceptable for a poet. A poet will have an audience writing that way. And there was a time when it would have been very hard for a poet to express simple Christian faith and be read. And I think now that time has passed, serious poets are able to do that again. Well, time. Yes.
You know, in the 60s it was all political, and now in the 70s we are more.
Thank you all. I think we've got.